You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When you order a cocktail in a modern high-end bar, although you might pay on an iPad and hear music coming out of Bluetooth speakers, many of the elements you'd find behind the bar are likely to have been inspired by the 19th century. The infused liquors, homemade bitters, hand-carved ice, and the bartender's waxed mustache, a vest with pocket squares to match. It's because people in the cocktail industry believe that the ideal artisanal bar should recreate an experience from around 200 years ago. But this obsession with 1800s cocktail culture overlooks some of the more controversial aspects of the era, specifically the contributions of African Americans to modern bartending and also how they were treated. David Wondrich, a writer, cocktail historian, and the senior drinks columnist at the Daily Beast, recently tackled the subject in an article called The Cunningest Compounders of Beverages, The Hidden History of African Americans Behind the Bar. It appears in the online magazine, The Bitter Southerner, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Wondrich back to our show.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
You start the article with Frank Beck in Cincinnati, Ohio. This takes place around post-Civil War?
Yeah, 1880s. And Frank Beck opened a bar. He was a German immigrant. The bar industry was very heavily German at the time. And he had a great location right by Cincinnati's New City Hall. And he had a great custom, lots of customers there. But his head bartender was slacking off on the job and giving him attitude, so he replaced him with one of his waiters. And this waiter, Lewis Dial, was a very good bartender, skillful, polite, clean, well-mannered, everything you want. But suddenly, Beck had no customers at all, and that's because Lewis Dial was black.
So there was a boycott. But people didn't object to being served by a black waiter, only a black bartender?
Waiters and bartenders had different social class, different social status. And the boycott was led by the customers, but actually not led by the customers. It was really led by the other bartenders at fancy bars all around town who threatened to put 100,000 flyers out on the street having people boycott Beck's bar unless he got rid of Dial, which is just a fascinating level of panic that they felt.
Especially a bartender named George Bear. Now, why would George Bear be so concerned about whether there's one black bartender in Cincinnati, Ohio?
Well, it's interesting and it's really complicated, and it kind of digs down into the great American problem with race. George Bear, when he was interviewed, he said, well, I don't object to black people working in bars, but there are lots of qualified white bartenders who deserve this job first. And that's already selfish and shows no, you know, solidarity. But off the record, some of his other bartenders said the real problem was that the status of the bartender is lowered by having a black person in that job. And if you look at labor reports from the late 19th century, you see that black Americans, while working very hard to move up the social ladder and to improve their prospects, you know, against heroic odds almost always, they almost always worked in jobs that were considered unskilled labor.
Now, this became a big news story, at least in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah.
How did it play out? Were the reporters sympathetic to Lewis Dial or to the boycotters?
The reporters took an interesting kind of semi-sympathetic attitude for Dial, but they didn't try to break the boycott. And they kind of looked at both sides and said, hands off, we're not getting involved in this. But ultimately, the owner had to cave and fire Dial.
But his hotel actually closed.
Yeah, it didn't help. By then, the damage was done, and he went out of business and lost all his money.
And there are some interesting parallels to today. Bear told the Cincinnati Inquirer that he was not a racist.
Yeah.
We hear that kind of language today as well.
The default language. Nobody's a racist if you ask them, you know, aside from certain horrible figures on the alt-right, or the new right, the old right, any of it. But in general, that doesn't really... that's not an admission that even then people were comfortable to make in the paper.
And what happened with Louis Diehl?
He went back to being a waiter, as far as we know, and then, disappears from the eye of history. That was his moment in the spotlight.
I suspect that this was a rather difficult story to research.
Yeah, these things
I didn't even discover this aspect of the story.
I spend a lot of time going through old newspapers looking for histories of cocktails, histories of famous saloons, biographies of bartenders. And years ago, I started coming across little items that mentioned something having to do with black bartenders. That was a surprise to me, in part. There were black bars for the black community. But to find black bartenders in white bars was a little unusual. And so I just opened a file, and eventually, over the years, I accumulated, dozens and hundreds of articles about this stuff. But they're all just little tiny pieces. It's very hard to put it together.
But weren't there black bartenders in the South during the years of slavery? In fact, you write about a bartender who was a slave.
Absolutely. Often...
It was different because
it was different
they were expected to be the servant.
Yeah, it was the servant class.
So there were boycotts in the North, but in the South it was perfectly okay.
In the South, these guys were celebrated. They were they had a unique status of their own. A really skilled black bartender in Richmond, Virginia, like John Dabney, who was the dean of Richmond's bartenders, was treated virtually as if he were white. As long as he didn't try to take advantage of that. It's very complicated. There are nuances in the South that I really don't even understand.
Well, he was a slave. Could he make money?
He made enough
from being
money
a bartender?
He made enough money to buy his freedom and his wife's.
And he is the source of the title, the cunning of your article, the cunningest compounder of beverages.
Yeah, he was written up in the Richmond paper after the Civil War. During the war, he kept his bar open. He was free by then because he'd bought his freedom. He kept his bar open in Richmond and served the white elite. After the war, he continued to do so at Richmond and out in summer resorts out in the mountains, and always making these huge, elaborate mint juleps for everybody, and secretly thinking very little of his customers, according to his son. But he was allowed to own property and was respected and even lauded by the premier white citizens of Richmond.
He didn't invent mint julep.
No, mint julep was old.
But you say that some of these Southern bartenders did invent drinks that we're still drinking today?
They certainly perfected them. The mint julep was at its most perfect development. It was a product of black bartenders in the South. There were numerous descriptions of these elaborate, gorgeous concoctions that they used to make. And when in 1860 the Prince of Wales visited Richmond, the city fathers sent Jim Cook, one of these guys, to make him a julep. And that was the only thing that the prince saw fit to mention about his visit to Richmond.
Have you seen the recipe?
The exact recipe doesn't survive, but descriptions of it survive. And it was a very large, elaborate drink with straws so it could be shared by the prince and his entourage. And in a big silver goblet, the whole thing. It sounds quite lovely.
My guest is David Wandrich. His article in the online magazine, The Bitter Southerner, I'm interested in the title of that magazine as well, is The Cunningest Compounders of Beverages, The Hidden History of African Americans Behind the Bar. You write of a drink that was pioneered in Richmond, Virginia, the Coit Club Punch. What was that?
Well, that was, all the social clubs, North and South, had their own versions of punch, this old English beverage that was antique even before America was was free. But the Coit Club Punch was rum and brandy and Madeira wine and lemon juice and so on, all served in a huge elaborate bowl to this social club that had the leading citizens of Richmond.
Is that where the bars would be, in social clubs and in taverns?
Often. Social clubs, taverns, those were the main places, mostly in taverns and restaurants, I guess you would call them.
You write that black people have been mixing drinks in America since the earliest days of European colonization. What would the bar have looked like?
The bars were a little booth with a wooden grate that you could slide down and lock, because usually the bar was in the lobby of a hotel. That was the other place you saw lots of these things. It was the bar counter was where you checked in. We still check in at a bar in a hotel, only they don't serve drinks anymore. Mm-hmm. But it used to be the bartender and the clerk was the same job. And you would show up and the bartender would mix you a drink, and at night they would lock all the liquor up behind this little cage. You could see one of those at the Mount Vernon Hotel here in the city, which is a little museum up in the East 60s.
Were there more black bartenders before the revolution than after?
I wish I knew. You know, that's one of the things that takes a much deeper level of historical research than I can do. But
And do we know whether there were many bars that were owned by black people?
Before the revolution, I don't know. One of the first bars in 19th century New York, one of the premier bars, was owned by Cato Alexander, who was a freedman who, as he told people, he had waited on George Washington in his youth. He was very proud of that. And he had a roadhouse up in the country, way north of the city, which nowadays is about 60th Street and 3rd Avenue.
Well, even today, if you tend to find black bartenders in black neighborhoods and white bartenders in the rest of the city. So what happened then? What kind of clientele did they serve?
Well, then a guy like Cato Alexander served all the sporting youth. Nowadays, it's troubling to me, and I'm not alone in this by any means, that there's still some of this segregation between... especially in craft cocktail bars, in these new style bars, as in your intro, where there are fewer, let's say black bartenders are underrepresented in this. There are some, and some really great ones who are, you know, appreciated and are masters of their craft. I think here in New York of Charles Hardwick, Frankie Marshall, Carl Franz Williams are just three, and there are numerous others, but it's still few. And the question is it because of some inherent bar, or to their advancement, or is it because it's the way the craft movement has evolved does not really answer black interest as much as it does certain parts of white interest? And that's a really tough question.
You're right that in the 19th century, bartending required years of apprenticeship as well as a host of physical mm-hmm. and mental toil, or menial toil as well. Could you talk a bit about that? What do they need to learn? I mean, you learn how to mix a few drinks.
You needed to learn how to make a lot of drinks. The standard American repertoire stretched to maybe... including variations, something like 100 drinks that had to be made just right. And there were no books early on. You know, you had to memorize all this stuff. You also needed to compound liquors. Whiskey was sold by the barrel, not by the bottle, and so you'd have to learn how to reduce it to the right proof to sell it, weak enough so you can make money, but not so weak that your customers complain. You'd have to make your own bitters and syrups and things like that. And then, you know, there were the business aspects. You'd have to make sure your bartenders weren't stealing. This was before the cash register, and bartenders had all kinds of dodges.
And they also had to learn to be psychologists in some cases.
As always, even now, you know, you still have to deal with your customers, and that's the hardest part. But that's where some of these black bartenders in the South were at their most successful. It's amazing. You know, they had some of the most systemically and overtly racist clientele. But a guy like Dick Francis in Washington D.C. was considered personal friends of some of the most racialist senators in the Senate.
They'd come and they would talk about their problems.
Well, once you're in the bar, it's a different space. A bartender has a unique relationship with his customer, back then it was it's very hard to maintain a certain haughty behavior when you're lounging at the bar and drinking with your friends and talking to the bartender. You know, the bartender's always present and sees all.
David Wondrich's article in the online magazine, The Bitter Southerner, is The Cunningest Compounders of Beverages, The Hidden History of African Americans Behind the Bar. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard. Such a pleasure.